The Federal News Update for Tuesday, January 6, 2026. Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today we are embarking on a deep analysis of a single, frankly, explosive day in American federal activity. January 5, 2026, it wasn't just another busy day. It was a day that really laid bare the core strategy of this administration.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And today, we're attempting something pretty ambitious. Our mission is to create an exhaustive, truly granular archival audio record of U.S. federal government activity for that one day, January 5, 2026. We are not just reporting headlines, we're tracking policy implementation across every relevant agency and branch.
And when you stack up all the actions from this one day, you know, the judicial filings, the regulatory shifts, the kinetic military action, you realize the landscape is being defined by two immense, almost conflicting forces.
That's right.
First, you have this radical reassertion of American unilateralism on the world stage. But at the same time, there's a profound, almost aggressive restructuring and repurposing of the national security and domestic apparatus right here at home.
Exactly. And if we zoom out for just a second, three central events really dominated the entire operational day. They acted as anchors for almost all the other decisions.
Okay, what were they?
First, the stunningly successful extraterritorial extraction and subsequent arraignment of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. That was the big one.
Absolutely huge.
Second, the operational implementation of renaming the Department of Defense to the Department of War, which, as we'll get into, is so much more than just a cosmetic change.
Right.
And third, the unilateral withdrawal from the OECD Global Minimum Tax Framework, which effectively shattered a major piece of international economic consensus.
That is a staggering amount of history packed into just 24 hours. So let's start immediately with the engine driving this whole tempo, the White House and macro executive strategy. We've been tracking this administration's focus on high volume personnel turnover since day one, but what did the activity on January 5th tell us about the current speed and, I guess, the efficiency of the strategy?
It showed us that their discipline is just unrelenting and their goal remains rapid, deep entrenchment. On January 5th, the White House sent a fresh tranche of nominations to the Senate, continuing a pace that's clearly designed to fill out the government with individuals loyal to the executive agenda.
And we have specific hard metrics that illustrate just how unprecedented this pace is. We really need to focus on those numbers because they define the scope of this political project.
The numbers are, they're startling. The administration recently confirmed 97 nominees in a single day.
97. In one day.
In a single day, often using these fast-track Senate procedures. And this focus push means the total number of confirmed nominees now stands at 415. Now, here's the crucial context.
Oh, one.
That figure, 415, it significantly outpaces the 323 confirmed at this exact same point during the first Trump term.
So that's nearly 100 more confirmed appointees in the same time frame. I'm thinking about the strategic why here. This can't just be about rewarding political allies. This feels like a systematic, almost military effort to bypass what they call the deep state.
That is the core analysis, absolutely. The speed reflects a disciplined, concerted effort to fill the career bureaucracy, the deep state, with politically aligned loyalists. And to do it rapidly enough that they can institutionalize their policy changes before any potential political pushback can even mount. They are using executive power very aggressively to bypass traditional bureaucratic vetting and hurdles.
So the immediate impact is that this high-tempo confirmation strategy just accelerates their entire policy agenda across the government landscape. I mean, from the Forest Service, which we'll get to later, all the way up to the State Department.
Precisely. They're making sure that policy implementation, once it's decided at the cabinet level, is carried out by loyalists embedded deep within the middle management of the agencies. It dramatically reduces the friction that so often plagues big policy changes in Washington.
Okay, so moving from personnel to presidential brand projection, the White House also made a major announcement regarding where the 2026 G20 summit, I mean, one of the highest profile diplomatic meetings in the world, will be hosted. And this immediately raised some eyebrows.
It certainly did. The president announced the summit location would be his own property, Trump National Doral, Miami. Now, the venue itself is obviously familiar to the president, but this immediately revived that longstanding debate over potential conflicts of interest.
Right, and the administration, they had to have known this criticism was coming. So they preempted that debate with a specific financial assurance. What was the exact statement they made about the cost?
The president stated the hosting would be provided at cost, assuring the public and critics that there would be no profit to the Trump Organization from the arrangement. This was clearly intended to head off those accusations of leveraging the presidency for private financial gain.
But regardless of that at-cost assurance, which I imagine is very difficult to audit, what is the clear strategic rationale for forcing the G20, a global diplomatic meeting, onto a property owned by the sitting president?
Well, the administration, they view the venue as more than just a site. They see it as a powerful projection of the president's personal brand, you know, his hospitality, and what they see is American success. The intent is to provide a very clear home court advantage for diplomatic negotiations, leveraging the familiarity and comfort of his own facilities.
And the unavoidable impact. You can't separate this from the continuous legal and ethical debate around the Emoluments Clause.
You're absolutely right. Even with the at-cost assurance, the decision is guaranteed to reignite debates regarding the Emoluments Clause and potential conflicts of interest. The sheer visibility provided to a Trump Organization property during a G20 summit that acts as free, unparalleled global advertising. That itself constitutes a significant financial benefit, even if the direct fees are zeroed out. It just blurs the line between public duty and private business in a way that remains deeply unsettling to ethics watchdogs.
Okay, let's pivot to the truly seismic event that consumed the news cycle on January 5th, the Venezuela operation. Extraction, lawfare, and geopolitical fallout. This is where that doctrine of maximalist unilateralism was put into direct military practice. So walk us through the cold, hard details of the extraction and the immediate legal filing.
Okay. This was a military operation resulting in the successful extraterritorial extraction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores. This was followed by their immediate transfer and arraignment right here in the United States. It was, the definition of a kinetic action wrapped in a legal justification.
Let's focus on that lawfare aspect. Where exactly were they arraigned and what were the precise criminal charges filed against them?
They were arraigned in the Southern District of New York on these long-standing narco-terrorism charges. Maduro pleaded not guilty to four specific very grave counts: narco-terrorism conspiracy, cocaine importation conspiracy, possession of machine guns and destructive devices, and conspiracy to possess machine guns and destructive devices.
And the exchange in court with Judge Alvin Hellerstein, that's critical for our archival record. What was Maduro's specific defense, or I guess his assertion in that federal courtroom?
His statements were incredibly clear and defiant. He told U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein, and I'm quoting here, "I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man." He also explicitly claimed he had been kidnapped by U.S. forces and, even while standing there in handcuffs, asserted that he was still the legitimate constitutional president of Venezuela.
The narrative from the administration, though, is that this was essentially a police action, albeit a very, very large one. How did they justify using U.S. military assets to apprehend an indicted foreign head of state on foreign soil?
They meticulously framed it as a surgical law enforcement operation. The design, they said, was to apprehend an indicted fugitive, a narco-terrorist, who they held responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Americans through drug trafficking. The rationale was simple: protecting Americans.
But the operational footprint was clearly military, not a handful of DEA agents. What specific U.S. forces were involved, according to Secretary Hegseth?
Secretary Hegseth, the newly minted Secretary of War, was very specific about the scope. He confirmed that about 200 U.S. forces were involved, and these elements included truly elite units. The Army's 75th Ranger Regiment and Delta Force were confirmed to have been on the ground in Caracas, executing the extraction. This level of force, it just confirms the gravity of the mission and the high risk they were willing to take.
Which brings us to the political and historical meaning of the action. This feels like the most aggressive assertion of U.S. regional dominance in decades.
It is the boldest, most direct assertion of the Monroe Doctrine, you know, that 19th century policy that views the Western Hemisphere as the exclusive sphere of U.S. influence that we have seen in the 21st century. The immediate impact is a forceful establishment of a red line against extra-hemispheric powers like Russia and China, who have had very strong economic and military ties to the Maduro regime.
And naturally, an operation of this magnitude, using elite military force on foreign soil without clear prior congressional authorization, it immediately triggered a severe constitutional conflict and war powers debate. We need to dissect that highly contentious Gang of Eight briefing.
Right. The briefing took place late on January 5th. Secretaries Marco Rubio from State and Pete Hegseth from War led the discussion with congressional leaders. And the tension was, by all accounts, palpable, because the administration knew Congress would demand to know why this didn't trigger the War Powers Resolution of 1973.
So for our listeners who might not be steeped in constitutional law, the War Powers Resolution, that's the mechanism that typically requires the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of putting U.S. armed forces into hostilities and then withdraw them within 60 to 90 days unless Congress authorizes it. What was the administration's primary defense to bypass this mechanism?
Their core argument was semantic, but it was absolutely crucial for their legal justification. They argued they are not occupying Venezuela and that the action was limited in scope, duration, and objective. They maintained it was an execution of the president's Article II authority to enforce U.S. law against an indicted fugitive, essentially treating it as a global arrest warrant carried out with military efficiency.
A sort of global police action.
Exactly.
And House Speaker Mike Johnson, he defended the mission's legality. What was his specific framing of it?
Johnson backed the administration fully. He stated the goal was not regime change in the classical sense, but rather a demand for a change in behavior and coercing the interim government to cease supporting narco-terrorism. He asserted that the action did not require prior congressional authorization, only notification, which the administration provided on their own timeline.
Now, the Democratic opposition was scathing. Senator Jeanne Shaheen accused the administration of outright deception. What was the specific substance of their complaint?
Senate Democrats felt completely blindsided and, frankly, misled. Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire noted the drastic military operation was, quote, entirely inconsistent with previous administration briefings that had denied any intention of kinetic action or regime change in Venezuela.
So they felt they'd been lied to.
That's exactly it. Senator Andy Kim from New Jersey labeled the operation a lie, claiming that Hegseth and Rubio had denied regime change intentions only weeks prior. The sentiment was really that the administration had been negotiating in bad faith, keeping the true nature of their plan completely hidden from Congress.
And the Democratic response wasn't just rhetorical, right? It included a specific legislative threat.
Correct. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer pledged to join other senators in forcing a vote later this week on a War Powers Resolution. Schumer stated this was necessary to reclaim the constitutional authority of Congress and prevent the president from unilaterally starting endless wars, which was, ironically, a promise Trump had made to end.
But the war powers issue wasn't the only constitutional conflict. There was also a major procedural controversy involving a bipartisan condemnation from two very senior senators.
This is a fascinating layer to the conflict. You have Senators Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, and Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, jointly condemning the administration for excluding the Senate Judiciary Committee from the briefing. Their argument was powerful.
Which was?
Their argument was, if the operation is fundamentally justified as a law enforcement action to capture an indicted fugitive, then the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the Department of Justice, has indisputable jurisdiction and absolutely should have been included.
So the Judiciary Committee's exclusion, it really highlights the administration's cynical use of legal language. They're calling it law enforcement when it's convenient for justification, but then treating it as a pure military action when it comes to briefing Congress.
Absolutely. It demonstrates the administration leveraging the ambiguity that's inherent in this kind of hybrid warfare. They want the judicial legitimacy of a law enforcement operation, but they also want the speed and secrecy of a military strike. The exclusion of the Judiciary Committee proves that the law enforcement pretext was, at least in part, a legal maneuver.
Okay, moving beyond Washington, the operation provoked sharp international and Mangia backlash. Globally, how did rivals and international bodies react to this assertion of the, what did he call it, the Donro Doctrine?
The reaction was swift condemnation. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called the U.S. action a dangerous precedent that risks normalizing the use of force over international law. The key opposition, though, came from the Maduro regime's remaining officials. The Venezuelan ambassador, Samuel Manada, he argued the motive was purely economic control over Venezuela's oil and natural resources. He stated the U.S. seeks to revive imperialist and fascist aggression anchored in that outdated Monroe Doctrine.
In the revelation of casualties, that confirms the severity of the confrontation on the ground.
Yes. Cuban authorities reported that 32 Cubans were killed in the U.S. assault in Caracas. This confirms a significant Cuban security or paramilitary presence that was actively defending Maduro. This dramatically raises the stakes, and it introduces a potential flashpoint with Havana.
And President Trump himself was defiant in framing his unique version of regional policy.
He dubbed his personal doctrine the Donro Doctrine, asserting that the U.S. is now running Venezuela, emphasizing total regional primacy. And the State Department immediately echoed this sentiment on social media, affirming this maximalist, unilateralist stance with the very blunt statement, "This is our hemisphere."
He also issued threats against other regional players, specifically Cuba and Colombia, right?
He did. Trump stated that Cuba is going down now that it has lost access to cheap Venezuelan oil, which signals potential for further aggressive action. And when he was asked if a similar operation could target Colombia, which has been critical of the administration's regional policy, Trump replied, "It sounds good to me." This rhetoric is intentionally inflammatory. It's meant to project raw power.
But while that kind of aggressive talk resonates with some, the most fascinating dynamic here is the dissent it is creating within the America First MAGA movement. What are the specific concerns being expressed by Republican strategists?
The major concern is mission creep and nation building. A Republican strategist, Brian Darling, warned that the American First MAGA movement fears a new round of nation building, which is exactly what they believe Trump was elected to end. They are, in his words, hoping it's just bluster that Trump will run Venezuela. They're drawing direct and very worried comparisons to the quagmires of Iraq and Afghanistan.
I saw former Representative Ron Paul also weighed in, highlighting that comparison directly.
He did. Paul declared unequivocally, "Regime change and nation building are back," and he described the Venezuelan operation as just another neocon operation. He drew an explicit parallel between Hegseth and Rubio's justifications for intervention and the rhetoric of the Bush administration leading up to the Iraq invasion, which is alarming the isolationist wing of the party.
And the public sentiment from the polling data we have seems to align more with that isolationist wing than with the administration's interventionism.
It does. A Reuters-Ipsos poll taken immediately after the strike showed significant public anxiety. 72% of Americans worry the U.S. will become too involved in Venezuela. And what's more, only 33% of respondents actually approved of the kinetic strike against Maduro. It suggests the public strongly supports American power, but they resist the use of force for regime change, even against a figure who is, you know, universally disliked.
Let's shift to the immediate financial market reaction. It's often called the Trump put in moments like these, where markets anticipate deregulation or political opportunities. We saw specific movement in the energy sector.
We did. The energy market reaction was a strong signal of anticipated long-term liberalization. West Texas Intermediate, or WTI crude, rose 1.4% to $58.11 per barrel. And Brent crude climbed 1.2% to $61.50. This rise was steady, which indicates the market doesn't fear a regional conflict that halts production, but rather it's pricing in the long-term prospect of higher Venezuelan production.
Which U.S. corporation specifically saw the largest benefit from this?
Companies with historical and, you know, current ties to Venezuela rallied significantly. Chevron, which is the only U.S. major with an active, though restricted, presence, saw its shares jump $8.51, that's 5.5%, to $164.49.
Wow.
And even more dramatic were the oil services giants. Halliburton and Schlumberger surged over 10% each. This reflects the anticipation of these lucrative contracts to rehabilitate Venezuela's degraded oil infrastructure, which is estimated to require up to $100 billion in investment over the next decade.
So the analyst's prognosis here seems tied directly to a successful regime change scenario.
Absolutely. Goldman Sachs analysts noted that the long-term prospect of this higher Venezuelan production increases the downside risks to our oil price forecast for 2027 and beyond. The core assumption is that a U.S.-friendly regime will successfully liberalize the energy sector and flood the market with cheap Venezuelan crude, increasing global supply.
And the president cemented that economic motivation with his own direct quote regarding the oil industry.
He did. He confirmed he spoke to oil companies before and after the operation, and he stated, "We're going to be taking out a tremendous amount of wealth out of the ground." That quote really eliminates any doubt that the economic opportunity, specifically oil access, was a central driver. And Energy Secretary Chris Wright further confirmed this priority by planning meetings with oil industry executives this week to discuss investment opportunities.
Now we have to address the difficult aftermath, post-Maduro transition and stability concerns. Who is currently running the government in Caracas, and what is the U.S. strategy regarding this new interim leadership?
Constitutionally, following Maduro's removal, his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, is next in charge. And this presents an immediate and very difficult political dilemma because she was deeply complicit in the regime.
So the U.S. has to decide whether to deal with a former regime loyalist simply because she represents some kind of continuity. What are the conflicting views on this transition strategy?
Well, you have former CIA station chief Rick Delator suggesting a pragmatic approach. He said the U.S. might need to pinch our nose and deal with Rodriguez temporarily just to prevent a power vacuum, ensure essential services stay operational, and start the transition process smoothly.
But the other side of that.
Conversely, former DEA station chief Dan Moritz framed the situation much more starkly. He called Venezuela a narco state and the arrest an outstanding statement. But he cautioned that Rodriguez is still seen by many as, quote, second in charge of the cartel.
And beyond the political jockeying, there are two key policy linkages here: migration and technology. Let's start with the motivation that's linked to the U.S. border situation.
Right. Democratic Representative Ami Berra from California stated that a central, if unspoken, motive for the administration's action is the ability to send Venezuelan migrants back home. This follows DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's earlier, very controversial revocation of temporary protected status, or TPS, for roughly 600,000 Venezuelans.
So the administration is effectively linking regime change to addressing the border crisis. The argument being that if Venezuela is stabilized under a U.S.-friendly government, then the conditions necessitating mass migration are eliminated.
That is precisely the argument. Secretary Noem confirmed that while individuals can still apply for refugee status, the ultimate goal is to remove the need for these temporary statuses by stabilizing the source country. It's linking U.S. foreign policy directly to domestic border enforcement.
And the technological intervention? Elon Musk inserted himself directly into the post-operation environment?
Yes, he did. SpaceX CEO Elon Musk announced that Starlink will provide free broadband satellite service to Venezuela through February 3rd. This action, publicly supporting the Venezuelan people, provides crucial communication infrastructure during a chaotic transition period when state media and internet access might be disrupted or controlled by residual loyalists. It's a really powerful example of private corporate intervention in a geopolitical crisis.
That is just a staggering amount of activity on the foreign policy and national security front. Let's shift our attention inward now to the profound domestic restructuring, the Department of War transformation and civil-military crisis. So the renaming is now operational.
It is. The president signed the executive order authorizing the use of the secondary title Department of War on January 2nd. By January 5th, the operational implementation was already underway.
Give us the specific details of that operational shift. What changed physically and, I guess, digitally?
Well, digitally, all assets were migrated to the new, highly symbolic domain, war.gov. Physically, signage changes began at the Pentagon complex, and the title Secretary of Defense is now preferably referred to as Secretary of War in all official executive branch communications. So although the statutory name is still the Department of Defense, the administration is forcing a cultural and operational shift by fiat.
What is the stated rationale provided by Secretary Pete Hegseth for this shift from defense back to war?
Hegseth framed the change as necessary to restore a warrior ethos that he believes was lost when the department was renamed back in 1947. He explicitly linked the defense era to a lack of major war victories. He argued that before that change, quote, "We won World War I, we won World War II, and then we decided to go woke, and we changed the name to DOD. We haven't won a major war since." So the stated goal is a singular focus on lethality and a rejection of what he calls progressive social policies.
So the impact is a cultural and doctrinal restructuring that deliberately sidesteps the legislative process, relying on executive command to instill this new ethos. But Hegseth didn't stop at rebranding. He took an unprecedented action to assert executive authority over the legislative branch, leading to the disciplinary action against Senator Mark Kelly.
This is truly a constitutional flashpoint. I mean, weaponizing the military system itself. Secretary Hegseth announced administrative action against Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, a sitting U.S. senator and a highly decorated retired Navy captain and astronaut.
What was the specific conduct that triggered this administrative review?
Hegseth cited a video Kelly made with five other lawmakers, all of whom are retired military or intelligence personnel, in which they urged active duty troops to refuse illegal orders if they believe them to be unconstitutional. Hegseth characterized this as seditious statements and reckless misconduct intended to undermine good order and discipline. He alleged it was incitement to mutiny.
Let's pause here, because this is where the legal jargon must be defined conversationally. The Department of War initiated a retirement grade determination proceeding under a very specific statute, 10 U.S.C. Section 1370. For our listener, what exactly does this statute authorize Hegseth to do to a retired officer's pay and rank?
Right. That statute, 10 U.S.C. Section 1370F, it grants the secretary the authority to review a retired service member's record and determined if the member's conduct after retirement justifies a reduction in their final retirement rank. So if the rank is reduced, say, from captain down to commander, their military pension is permanently reduced proportionally. This is the weapon. They are attacking Kelly's economic security, which is tied to his decades of service, not his seat in the Senate.
And the action taken was twofold. The initiation of this proceeding and a specific filing for his permanent record.
Yes. The process aims to downgrade Kelly's retirement rank and therefore reduce his military pension. And second, a formal letter of censure was issued for placement in his permanent military file. Hegseth also reminded Kelly that he remains subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ, even as a sitting senator, asserting that his status does not exempt him from accountability for actions that undermine the integrity of the armed forces.
And Senator Kelly's response was immediate and focused not just on his own defense, but on the implications for all former service members in public life.
Kelly called the action outrageous and wrong. He vowed to fight it, to send a message that Hegseth and Trump don't get to decide what Americans in this country get to say about their government. And he explicitly contrasted his 20-plus years of service with Trump's history of draft deferments, directly questioning Hegseth's moral authority to challenge his patriotism.
So the ultimate impact here is immense. This is an unprecedented move that asserts executive disciplinary power over the legislative branch, using the pension system to enforce political compliance.
It sets a chilling precedent. This action serves as a third-order effect. It's not just about Mark Kelly. It sends a very clear message across the entire community of retired military personnel who might consider running for office or speaking critically of the executive. The message is, you risk your pension, your rank, and your livelihood if your political speech is deemed seditious by the Secretary of War. This directly challenges the separation of powers.
Let's transition from military conflict to economic unilateralism, the Department of the Treasury and economic sovereignty. Treasury made a monumental move on January 5th to dismantle a core piece of global economic consensus that was negotiated by the previous administration.
This was the withdrawal from the OECD global minimum tax framework. Treasury announced it has secured an agreement to effectively exempt U.S. headquartered companies from the OECD Pillar 2 global minimum tax framework.
Okay, for our listeners, what is the OECD Pillar 2 global minimum tax? And how does this U.S. exemption work, specifically regarding something called the UTPR?
Right. The OECD Pillar 2 was a global agreement to ensure large multinational corporations pay at least a 15% minimum effective tax rate no matter where they operate. The key enforcement mechanism is the Undertaxed Profits Rule, or UTPR. This rule allows foreign jurisdictions to impose a top-up tax on U.S. companies if the U.S. rate is below 15%. By securing this exemption, the U.S. ensures its multinationals are shielded from this top-up tax by foreign countries.
So U.S. companies will still be subject to U.S. tax regimes like JLTI, but foreign nations can't use the OECD framework to enforce a minimum tax on them. What is the administration's stated rationale for prioritizing this tax sovereignty?
Treasury officials argued this decision promotes U.S. competitiveness. It ensures American companies are answerable only to American tax laws and are not subject to what they call tax colonialism by foreign treasuries. They prioritize the ability of Congress, not some international body, to set tax policy.
But the long-term impact is predictable. This has to lead to global fragmentation and possible retaliation.
Oh, absolutely. While it benefits U.S. corporations immediately, critics like the AFTI Coalition warn this move risks a retaliatory fragmentation of the global tax system. Other nations, already frustrated, are very likely to impose unilateral countermeasures, things like digital services taxes, DSTs, or aggressive tariff regimes targeting U.S. tech giants in response. It moves the global system from multilateral governance back toward fractured bilateral competition.
And Treasury's actions weren't purely focused on global tax norms. They directly complemented the Venezuela operation with targeted Venezuela sanctions.
That's right. The Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, sanctioned several oil traders on January 5th. This action targeted specific traders engaged in these elaborate evasion schemes that were designed to funnel oil revenue to the now-removed Maduro regime.
The why is tactical financial warfare, right? To prevent remaining loyalists from accessing any cash.
Precisely. The sanctions aim to immediately choke off revenue streams that might support regime loyalists, the armed colectivos, or paramilitary groups, during this leadership transition. It ensures the kinetic strike is backed up by financial pressure to prevent any reconsolidation of power.
Switching gears, let's look at Homeland Security and domestic law enforcement high-tempo operations. The FBI announced the disruption of a significant domestic terror plot on January 5th.
Yes, the FBI disruption of an ISIS-inspired plot in North Carolina. The FBI and DOJ unsealed a criminal complaint against Christian Sturtevant, an 18-year-old from Mint Hill, North Carolina. This was a classic case of online radicalization leading to a plan for domestic violence.
What were the specific details of his plot and the material evidence they gathered?
Sturtevant was radicalized online and planned a New Year's Eve attack targeting a grocery store and a fast food restaurant, believing these to be soft targets. He communicated with an undercover FBI employee, pledging his loyalty, his bayat, to ISIS. A search of his residence yielded the intended weapons, knives and hammers, along with a handwritten manifesto titled New Year's Attack 2026. He was charged with attempting to provide material support to a designated terrorist organization.
And this action reinforces the administration's narrative about the need for aggressive federal surveillance powers against domestic threats.
It does. The official statements from the DOJ and FBI Director Kash Patel reinforce the necessity of aggressive federal surveillance powers against evil ISIS sympathizers and domestic radicalization threats, claiming the rabid collaboration saved countless lives.
Law enforcement also maintained a high tempo challenging specific state sanctuary policies, notably with the ICE surge operations challenging sanctuary policies in California.
ICE completed a very high-profile six-day surge operation in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties in California. This culminated in the announcement of 118 arrests of illegal aliens. The agency made it explicit that this operation targeted non-cooperative jurisdictions and focused on individuals with prior criminal records to undermine the sanctuary narrative.
Let's pull out the most egregious criminal profiles highlighted by ICE in their press release, as they clearly intend this to be a political statement.
They highlighted several profiles to, shock the public. These included Juan Perez Tello, a registered sex offender convicted of lewd or lascivious acts with a child under 14, and Jose Cano Cruz, who was convicted of homicide by a vessel and aggravated stalking. The message was clear. These are the criminals that sanctuary policies are protecting.
And Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin made the political intent unavoidable in her direct attack on the state's leadership.
McLaughlin directly attacked California Governor Gavin Newsom. She asserted that ICE is doing what Gavin Newsom refused to do, make California safe again. She accused the governor and his colleagues as creating a haven for criminal illegal aliens who were allowed to terrorize innocent American families.
We also saw a significant separate enforcement action regarding drug trafficking that links back to that same critique of California, the drug trafficking interdiction in Indiana.
ICE lodged detainers for two Indian nationals, Gurpreet Singh and Jazavir Singh, who were arrested in Putnam County, Indiana. The detail here is just the scale. They were arrested with a massive shipment of 309 pounds of cocaine hidden in a semi-truck.
And the Department of Homeland Security seized on a seemingly small bureaucratic detail, the commercial driver's licenses, to broaden their critique of California.
Yes, they pointed out that both individuals held commercial driver's licenses, or CDLs, issued by the state of California. DHS used this detail to criticize what they called California's lax regulatory environment, linking it to transnational drug trafficking and organized crime. And the dramatic contextualization of the seizure, amount enough to kill more than 113,000 Americans, just amplified the critique of border security and state policies.
Let's move to the Department of Justice and regulatory enforcement beyond the Maduro arraignment. The DOJ is prioritizing long-term enforcement strategies, including these denaturalization efforts with Operation Janitor.
Right. The DOJ filed a civil complaint to revoke the citizenship of Cede Milskovich, also known as Cede Dukic. This is a continuation of Operation Janitor, which is a systematic review targeting naturalized citizens suspected of obtaining their status fraudulently by concealing participation in war crimes or human rights abuses.
What were the specific horrific details of the war crimes Milskovich is alleged to have committed back in 1994, which he allegedly concealed during his 2007 naturalization?
Milskovich, a former member of the Autonomous Province of Western Bosnia Security Forces, is accused of participating in severe war crimes. The allegations state he specifically participated in beating 12 civilians with wooden bats and then locking them in a morgue for 5 days without light or water. He obtained citizenship by concealing his identity and a Bosnian arrest warrant related to these acts.
And Assistant Attorney General Brett Schumann used this case to send a very clear long-term message about immigration vetting.
Schumann's statement was a clear warning. It aligns with the administration's broader skepticism of immigration vetting processes. He said, "Decades might pass, but when we find you, we will take action. The impact is that it serves as a warning that naturalized status is absolutely revocable if it was procured through fraud, no matter how much time has passed since the original deception.
And finally, in other DOJ action, we have a corporate fraud resolution.
A quick one. Teledyne Electronic Safety Products agreed to pay a settlement of $1.5 million to resolve False Claims Act allegations regarding defense contracting fraud. This just reinforces the administration's stated priority of maintaining integrity in contracting and recovering funds lost to fraud.
Now we come to one of the most controversial domestic moves of the day, located within federal agencies and regulatory changes. The dramatic shift in public health policy regarding children's vaccines, the HHS-CDC, unprecedented childhood vaccine schedule shift.
This is a massive, immediate policy reversal. Federal health officials announced they have reduced the number of vaccines routinely recommended for children. This fulfills a key campaign promise of HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and aligns the U.S. schedule with Denmark.
Let's get the precise reduction. How many vaccines are being removed from the standard routine recommendation, and which specific ones are no longer routinely recommended for every child?
Okay. The CDC will now recommend 11 vaccines, which is a significant reduction from the current list of 17. Specifically, the agency will no longer routinely recommend vaccines for rotavirus, influenza, meningococcal disease, RSV, hepatitis A, and hepatitis B for every child. They'll only recommend these for high-risk groups or through specific physician consultation. They've moved them from routine care to discretionary care.
What is Secretary Kennedy's explicit justification for this policy reversal? He's framing it as a way to rebuild trust.
Kennedy stated the change aligns the schedule with international consensus, specifically the Danish model, and is meant to rebuild trust in public health by addressing declining public trust in routine vaccines like measles. He argued the decision protects children, respects families, and rebuilds trust in public health by emphasizing informed consent and transparency, and this responds to the president's order to compare the U.S. schedule with peer nations.
But the immediate reaction from the mainstream medical and public health community has been alarm, with experts warning of increased disease risk. Why is the comparison to Denmark misleading, as medical experts are arguing?
Well, experts, including those from the American Academy of Pediatrics Infectious Diseases Committee, decried the move. They're saying there is zero scientific or epidemiological justification for removing these particular vaccines. They argue the comparison to Denmark is deeply misleading because Denmark has a vastly different public health infrastructure, universal healthcare access, and significantly different disease exposure rates and population density compared to the U.S.
So simply cutting the vaccines without having the Danish social and medical infrastructure in place, it creates a massive gap. What is the fear regarding the long-term impact?
The fear is disease outbreaks. Sean O'Leary noted the move risks confusing the public and exacerbating vaccine hesitancy, allowing infectious diseases that were nearly eradicated, like hepatitis B or rotavirus, to blossom again. The stated rationale of increasing trust is undermined by the lack of scientific consensus. David Margolius, who's Cleveland's public health director, he called the policy incredibly confusing for no reason. Now, while coverage under Medicare, Medicaid, and CHA remains available if families want the shots, the official recommendation change sends a powerful and many would say negative signal.
And we have another critical HHS action, this one targeting anti-DEI policy within federal grants for early education, Head Start anti-DEI guidance in grant applications. This generated a massive operational conflict.
It did. Trump officials barred Head Start providers, which serve millions of low-income families, from using dozens of terms associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, in federal grant applications. This is a direct implementation of the administration's vow to root out DEI initiatives across the government.
And this guidance is highly granular. Which terms are specifically discouraged, or in some cases, outright banned in the applications?
The list is extensive and politically charged. Terms discouraged included race, belonging, pregnant people, Black, Native American, disability, and women. One Head Start director in Wisconsin reported receiving an initial list of nearly 200 discouraged words.
But this creates an immediate and arguably illegal systemic breakdown because Head Start directors are required by law to report certain demographic data to the federal government. So how can they comply with the law if the terms needed for compliance are banned in the grant application?
That is the core conflict. Plaintiffs in pending litigation argue the guidance is forcing providers into an impossible situation. The Head Start Act specifically requires directors to provide demographic information about their families, which may necessitate using some of the banned words like Black or disability. Complying with the administration's guidance could mean violating the statutory requirements of the Head Start Act, and that could risk the loss of the program's license or funding.
And there was a specific, egregious example related to tribal populations.
Yes. A Head Start program on a Native American reservation in Washington state was told they had to cut all diversity and inclusion-related activities, which forced them to drop crucial training on supporting autistic children. And crucially, they were also told they can no longer prioritize tribal members for enrollment. This directly violates the explicit language of the Head Start Act, which expressly permits such prioritization based on tribal membership. So the impact is that this guidance isn't just cosmetic. It is forcing fundamental changes to who is served and how they are served.
Let's turn to WDW and Army Technology and Workforce updates. We have a necessary IT security memo and a strategic shift toward AI.
Right. Regarding IT security, a new DoD memo was issued titled Multi-Factor Authentication for Unclassified and Secret DoD Networks. The detail here is that it authorizes alternative login options beyond the standard Common Access Card, the CACPKI, when CAC access is impractical or infeasible. This aims to increase operational flexibility, especially for remote users or special operations where physical CAC readers are cumbersome without sacrificing security.
And the Army is making a long-term investment in future technological capacity.
The Army launched a new career field dedicated to artificial intelligence, AI, and machine learning for its officers. Applications opened on January 5th via the Voluntary Transfer Incentive Program. This is a strategic move, reflecting the realization that AI expertise can't just be outsourced.
What will these officers do, and what's the timeline for that?
Selected officers will undergo graduate-level training and gain hands-on experience in building, deploying, and maintaining the service's AI-enabled systems. The formal transfer date is October 2026. The Army is also considering expanding this specialty to warrant officers, showing a commitment to embedding AI expertise across the force hierarchy.
Okay, finally, let's cover the last agency updates, starting with the VA and its technological shortcomings, and then the staggering USDA attrition crisis.
Starting with the VA, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York questioned the agency on IT accessibility following an inspector general finding. The IG report showed a severe failure. Only 4 out of 30 critical IT systems at the VA met accessibility requirements mandated by federal law.
That is a basic failure of compliance for a population that disproportionately relies on accessibility features. What were the root causes cited for that?
The IG cited inadequate coordination across departments and a critical lack of Section 508 training. That's the federal regulation that requires agencies to make their electronic and information technology accessible to people with disabilities. It was a failure of training for agency acquisition professionals. So this isn't a funding problem. It's a systemic failure of training and coordination, and it's directly impacting disabled veterans.
Now let's talk about the USDA attrition crisis. This number is astronomical, and it speaks to a catastrophic institutional vulnerability. This massive employee loss detailed in a recent report.
The report detailed a genuine crisis in human capital. More than 20,000 employees left USDA in the first half of 2025 alone. To put that in perspective, the Forest Service, which manages vast swaths of federal land and fights wildfires, lost over 5,800 employees. The scale suggests a deliberate emptying of the ranks.
And the method of departure is also revealing, isn't it?
It is. A staggering 15,000 employees left via the Deferred Resignation Program, which suggests they were incentivized or pressured to leave rather than retiring naturally. The areas hardest hit were Texas, California, and Washington, D.C. And crucially, the office of the secretary lost the highest percentage of employees, approximately 67%.
Losing 2/3 of the personnel in the secretary's administrative backbone, that suggests not just inefficiency, but a strategic objective. This aligns perfectly with the administration's goal of dismantling the so-called deep state, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. When the secretary's office loses 67% of its staff, the ability of that agency to manage complex regulatory or scientific programs is severely compromised. This accelerated attrition, whether it's intentional or a byproduct of a hostile environment, systematically reduces the USDA's capacity to regulate, enforce, or even execute core functions like food safety or conservation efforts. It provides a clear pathway for deregulation by neglect. And this vulnerability really sets the stage for our final synthesis.
This brings us to the second and third order insights and synthesis, the strategic lessons we can extract when we stack all this activity together. Let's start by revisiting the most profound domestic assertion of power, the weaponization of institutions, the lawfare counteroffensive.
The administration is systematically leveraging institutional mechanisms, legal, administrative, and financial, to enforce political compliance against perceived domestic enemies. The retirement-grade determination proceeding against Senator Kelly under 10 U.S.C. Section 1370 is the most striking example of this sophisticated strategy.
We define the process, but we need to underscore why this is a third-order effect. What is the lasting, chilling consequence beyond just Mark Kelly himself?
The long-term chilling effect is immense. By asserting that a retired officer's political speech is subject to executive discipline through the UCMJ and the pension system, the action extends the executive's reach far beyond the immediate target. It chills dissent across the entire veteran community. It forces thousands of retired military personnel who might seek Congress or speak publicly to choose between their guaranteed pension, their economic security, and their freedom of political speech. It makes military service a potential lifetime political liability, which radically alters the civil-military separation.
Moving back to foreign policy, the immediate success in Venezuela may be fleeting. We need to analyze the imminent shift to hybrid conflict and geopolitical risk that's likely to follow this kinetic action.
Right. Intelligence analysts predict that the immediate success of the extraction will quickly give way to a protracted phase of hybrid conflict in Venezuela. The financial market optimism we saw that Trump put, it may be dangerously premature if stabilization fails.
So what are the specific threats of asymmetrical retaliation that could destabilize oil production or the new interim government?
The primary risk comes from remnants of the Maduro regime, heavily armed colectivos, and splintered security units. These groups are highly likely to engage in guerrilla warfare or sabotage of oil infrastructure pipelines, refineries, transport hubs. And this asymmetrical conflict could be funded by continuing narcotics revenue and supported by geopolitical patrons like Russia and China, who have strong reasons to see the U.S. mission fail. And this creates the strategic paradox. The U.S. succeeded in the high-stakes state-on-state phase, but they may now be bogged down in the very kind of costly nation-building stabilization mission that the Mejia base explicitly feared. It could undermine the entire rationale for the intervention.
And the final geopolitical consequence we need to synthesize is the fragmentation of global economic norms caused by the Treasury Department's unilateral withdrawal from the OECD tax framework.
Right. The exemption of U.S. companies from the OECD tax deal, while it was framed as tax sovereignty, inevitably risks diplomatic and economic fragmentation. The U.S. essentially tore up a multilateral agreement.
So, if the U.S. shields its companies from the global minimum tax, how are other nations likely to retaliate or protect their own tax bases?
The global financial system will move away from unified standards. Other nations will likely respond with unilateral countermeasures to recoup that lost revenue. This will primarily manifest as aggressive unilateral digital services taxes, or DSTs, or targeted tariff regimes specifically aimed at U.S. tech giants and multinationals. It will disrupt global trade and force U.S. companies to navigate dozens of fractured bilateral tax rules instead of one multilateral standard.
This relentless maximalist approach, both domestically and internationally, forces us to confront a deeper philosophical question, especially as the American system approaches a historic milestone. The American system at 250, late republic or new beginning?
The atmosphere is really permeated by late-stage capitalism and late republic narratives. We are seeing the rise of post-liberalism gaining serious traction. This is an ideology that asserts the foundational Enlightenment ideas of limited government, natural rights, and constitutional checks are defunct and must be subordinated for the good of the whole.
And we see two very distinct and highly aggressive visions for what this post-liberal state should look like, corresponding roughly to the political right and left.
On the nationalist right, this vision embraces a form of Caesarism, where the strong executive, led by the president, wields near total power, subordinating the legislative and judicial branches, and curbing individual liberties in the pursuit of national greatness. And this requires the total dismantling of bureaucratic resistance, which we see playing out in the high-volume confirmations and agency attrition. And then, on the anti-liberal left, there's an equally dark view of the American future, advocating for a form of systemic collectivism that replaces the constitutional structure. The argument is that the frigidity of rugged individualism failed to address systemic inequality and climate catastrophe, requiring radical structural change.
And the significance of this debate is heightened because the country is approaching its 250th anniversary. We often look back to the political chaos and widespread pessimism surrounding the 1976 bicentennial.
Exactly. Political commentators like Chris Starwalt note that in 1976, America felt like a late republic, struggling with Vietnam, Watergate, energy crises. and yet the subsequent quarter century was marked by great economic and global success. The debate now is whether the profound constitutional challenges we're seeing, the war powers conflicts, the weaponization of the military, the undermining of core agencies, make this moment fundamentally different, or if the system still retains the resilience for another great American comeback.
Which brings us to our final synthesis of January 5, 2026. This day was a microcosm of the administration's grand strategy, maximalist unilateralism.
Without a doubt. The federal government systematically used the day to dismantle constraints, both international with the OECD exemption and the violation of Venezuelan sovereignty, and domestic by challenging war powers and asserting executive control over civil-military separation, all to assert executive prerogative and American primacy.
The administration is clearly betting that dramatic, tangible results, like the capture of a hostile foreign leader and potential access to vast oil wealth, will justify the shattering of norms required to achieve them. It is an enormous high-stakes gamble on the willingness of the American public and the international community to accept the means for the sake of the perceived ends.
And the means involved both military force abroad and administrative lawfare right here at home.
Which leads us to the provocative thought we leave you with for this deep dive. Contemplate the tension. While the physical capture of a hostile foreign leader projects clear American strength globally, the simultaneous administrative action against a retired American senator serving in Congress asserts a form of executive power at home that risks internal constitutional stability. So which challenge, the external projection of force or the internal consolidation of power, poses the greater long-term risk to the structure of the American government?